until you are on a boat out in the ocean, such vast ocean in a flimsy wooden boat like that, you could never ever understand or imagine how vulnerable and insignificant you are.
Welcome to Herstory, an RTRFM podcast series exploring the lives and success stories of women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll be with you each week as we hear stories from some of the trailblazing women who've left their mark on not just Western Australia, but across the globe. Speaking of across the globe, episode 2 today starts in Vietnam with Dr. Karina Huang. Inducted in the inaugural 2011 class, Dr. Huang is a fierce advocate for the rights of refugees, with her own experience as a refugee shaping much of her life and career.
I'm too shy to call myself Dr. Huang.
Well, you've earned that title.
Yes, okay. Yes, I am Dr. Karina Huang. I would rather you call me that instead of me introduce myself
as that, okay? Of course, I will, absolutely. Let's start way back at the top. Can you tell us a bit about what your childhood was like before you left Vietnam?
You know, even though I was born and raised during the war, I consider my childhood was quite normal compared to other children in the world that I know. Because when I was born, the war was already ongoing. And that was always away, you know, in the military or out on the battlefield. And he would come home once in a while and we would celebrate with him and had fun. So I thought that was normal. I thought war was part of life. However, with my childhood, I had friends and siblings and mom and relatives. It was fun, you know, just about going to school, play with friends, come home, play with your siblings. And it was wonderful. And also, we had both grandmothers living with us. So it was very interesting.
It's a real family time for you.
Big time, yes.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about what that sort of experience was like. Tell us a bit about your family.
We grew up very comfortably because my mom was a very successful businesswoman. My dad, like I said, was an officer. He was hardly home. And financially, I think mom was a real breadwinner. It's very common in Vietnam to have housekeepers and drivers and gardeners and all that. So we were very well looked after.
So was your mum kind of a role model then? I mean, she was working and like you said, being a breadwinner.
Most women in Vietnam during the time I grew up, because of the war, they are pretty much head of the household. They're very capable people, but my mom was always my role model. And now that I have lived overseas and see different societies and how women's roles were played, my mom is incredible. She definitely is my hero.
Can you remember as a child, Karina, some people have early memories of wanting to be like an astronaut or, I don't know, a chef. Do you have any of those memories of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
No, because my mom already told me what I should become when I grew up. So I just play around with that image. My mom wanted me to become a medical doctor. And she instilled in my head the idea that I will head up a public hospital to treat poor people, and she will pay me. As a child, that sounds great, you know? And funny enough, I carried that desire and aspiration into later in my life. When I was in college in America, I signed up to be in a pre-medicine program, thinking that I would become that medical doctor, I would treat poor people. But reality hit that who's going to pay me? Who's going to pay for my insurance and pay for the student loan? You know, but yeah, that was my dream when I was a child.
So maybe not the doctor side in the medical world, but I mean, you are Dr. Karina. I imagine that sort of idea and that desire to help people less fortunate has also carried into your adult life.
You know what? You're the first person who pointed this out to me. I haven't thought of it that way, but yes, I guess now people call me Dr. Karina Huang, and it's not necessarily a medical doctor, but also I help people heal their wounds in a way, not necessarily physical wounds or sickness, but people who carry pain of losing loved ones or some traumas in their lives that they are still feeling saddened by it. So yes.
You do.
Wow. Thank you.
Thank you. I didn't do anything. You did make your mum proud then. You did. You were a doctor. You did help people.
Yes, she's very proud. In fact, when I graduated from Curtin here in WA, I did bring my gown and hat to Vietnam to celebrate with my mom and put on the hat and gown for her to take photos with. And she invited a lot of her friends over to kind of show off.
I mean, we all get one graduation ceremony. You had two.
Yes, indeed.
You mentioned there that there was college and study in America for you. And I want to talk about how that happened for you. But of course, we have to start with leaving Vietnam. You left Vietnam in 1979. Can you tell us a bit about what was happening in Vietnam at that time and how you ended up leaving?
We will go back to April 30th, 1975. That was the date that has changed the fate of many lives in Vietnam, and it's changed my life and my family. Started out with the communists from North Vietnam took over South Vietnam, and my family were in the U.S. Embassy trying to be evacuated. We saw the helicopter going up and down and we missed our turn. Now that we said this, I'm sort of reflecting on what we recently saw with the Afghanistan, you know, in Kabul situation. We missed that chance. Then we got out of the U.S. Embassy walking home with all these fears of what might happen to us. And our fear materialized in front of us instantly. Our house was confiscated. We were not allowed to go home, so we became homeless overnight. Our dad at that point, we lost touch with him for 4 days before that, so we had no idea if he was alive or dead or, you know, got out of Vietnam safely. But in the end, we found out that our father was captured the day before the fall of Saigon by the communists, and then they were about to execute him. He was hand-bound and blindfolded and ready. They were ready to shoot him, but then they stopped. But in replace of shooting him, they incarcerated him for 14 years without trial or sentence. So for 14 years, we all lived with the unknown of when and if we'll see our father again. So our father was taken away. Our house was confiscated. We couldn't go to school for a couple of years. And then my mom could not get a job with the government because of her husband's background. She could not register a business. So it's extremely difficult for my mom, not knowing what happened to her husband, all of a sudden on her own, carry around seven little kids and her mother and her mother-in-law, homeless and unable to work and bring money home. I don't know how my mom did it, but she did. We were constantly being forced to go to new economic zones, and the government created these areas basically in rural land or uncultivated lands where people were pushed there to survive with the bare hands away from the city. Some of them was in the border of Cambodia. And my mom knew that with her kids and her elderly mothers, we won't survive. So she constantly tried to find money and bribe local authorities for us to stay. So those are the things that people around us in Saigon, including us or South Vietnam, suffer. We were not the only one. Having said that, my mom did not want us to escape because not only is dangerous and it costly, but she does not want to leave our father in prison without us around waiting for him or help him when he is sick. But at the same time, she didn't want to let her children go without her. However, in 1978, when Vietnam had war in Cambodia, the government drafted young people to go to war starting at 16. And my mom knew that her three oldest children were at age and also will be drafted because of our background. So that was the time when she found the courage to let go. So 1979, I left Vietnam with my little sister and little brother, and they were 10 and 12. But the year before, I had two other siblings that already escaped.
So a war is what drove your family into that predicament and into that situation of your mum having to work in these rural areas and your father being imprisoned. And then another war is the impetus for you to finally be able to escape.
Yes. Ironically, what happened to us that drew us to leave the country in such condition was actually in the aftermath of war. we were supposed to have peace. The war ended. But then the persecution was the new war that we suffer.
Was there less attention paid to Vietnam at the time after the war had officially ended?
More attention was paid to Vietnam after the war ended was mainly because of the Boat People Exodus.
Can you explain to us a little bit about what that is?
The Exodus involved nearly a million Vietnamese boat people who made it to neighboring countries, but it was estimated up to 2 million people tried to flee the country, and in a very dangerous way. In retrospect, I now realize that the chance of survival for us was only 10%. The UNHCR estimated 1 out of 3 perished. Supposedly, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese boat people died during the journey. The boat journey was extremely dangerous. In so many ways, we could be taken down by storm. The boat might be fell, and then we would be drifted in the water until we ran out of food and water, and actually cannibalism took place. Or we could be captured by pirates, and that would be the worst atrocities that we could endure, because the pirates, not only they were there to take our valuables, but they rape women and girls repeatedly in front of their loved ones. They threw babies in the ocean. They killed the husband in front of their families. And it's just unbearable. It was just unbelievable. People died along the way due to exhaustions. And then we ended up in refugee camps. Like my case, it wasn't even a camp. It was in a jungle. But prior to that, due to different laws and regulations, that some of us were shot at by military personnel of countries in the region. We can talk about that later if you like, but my boat was shot at by Malaysian military.
Well, let's talk about your journey out of Vietnam. You get word that the war is coming and that some of your siblings will be conscripted or will be called up for duty. That's when it really starts to change for you. What were you feeling at the time at the thought of leaving the country that you were born and raised in?
If it was my decision, I wouldn't go, because I did not want to leave my family. I want to be with my mom and my siblings and wait for my dad. But the decision was made for me out of necessity. So I took my mom's decision and know that it's my responsibility to look after my siblings. So we went. So it was sad, full of anger. You know, I resented everything. I was angry at the world, angry at the people, angry at the communists, angry at war, that I have to leave my family. And then once we're on the boat, everything else is in the hands of God, really, you know, because we don't have much control over our destiny at that point. You want to talk about my boat journey? We got on the boat. That was quite large in my mind at the time, because it was 25 meters in length, 4.5 meters by width. But then if you think of 373 people cramming through that space, it became extremely small. We all sat with knees to our chins, you know, for the whole duration. The first day we encountered a huge storm, to the point where everybody started to pray and cry and thought that we all would die that night. Because I remember the waves were higher than, you know, multiple-story buildings. It was so big. I felt extremely vulnerable and insignificant. And then people started to cry, pray, vomit, scream through the night. And in the morning, the storm subsided. And all of a sudden, we were left with vomit, feces, water, stench, you know, all of that horrible things around us, and we sat with that for the rest of the duration. Luckily for us, the storm only lasted one day and night. And then the following days, we were chased by pirates a couple of times. Luckily for us, the pirates came near the boat, but then they left us. And until today, I could not understand why they didn't pursue our boat to the end. But prior to them arrive to our boat, the captain sent women and children to the bottom of the boat. And I remember my sister and myself, we picked up the vomit and feces and grease or whatever we can put our hands on to smear our face and body and hair, make us smell bad and look bad, hoping that the pirates would spare us. Like I said, we were lucky the pirates didn't come on our boat in the end, but afterward, I talked to other people who experienced the atrocities, and they said that would not have saved us if we were caught. So for a couple of days with that fears and exhaustions and hungry, people starting to feel the fatigue. By the third or fourth day, we came near Malaysia shore. And all of a sudden, everybody woke up with this new burst of energy. We felt relieved, we felt hopeful, and we know that we are saved. You know, we will be saved soon and feeling alive. And we came near the shore, and then we heard gunshots. And we didn't know who was shooting at who, but it turned out that the Malaysian military was shooting at our boat to stop us from coming near the shore. They towed our boat back to sea, and then they robbed us before they left and told us not to return. They even took our navigation tools away. And what happened was on June 1st, 1979, Malaysian government introduced the pushback policy, stop the boat. They declared that they would shoot to kill, and we arrived on June 2nd without knowing about that. At that point, we couldn't return to Vietnam. We had to get away from Malaysia, so we wandering down to Indonesia. And along the way, we have lost a few people that I had to watch bodies being tossed to the ocean. And it was extremely hard to watch and emotional when you see the family wailing and screaming and begging to hang on to the bodies of their loved ones so they can bury them later. Eventually, we landed on a fisherman village, and they had only less than 100 people as a population. So the captain of our boat sunk the boat purposely so that they cannot push us out to sea. They let us disembark and let us stay in the jungle until they contacted the local authorities. And then the local authority came over with small wooden raft and took us to another island, but it was uninhabited, and we were left there with bare hands, no shelters, not a refugee camp as we were told. In front of us was the ocean, behind us was the jungle. We were spread on the sand beach, confused.
Mm.
And then things started to go down from there. We survived the sea journey only to get on this island and watch people die every day.
So no help, no food, no water or shelter?
No, not at all. Eventually, people wandered into the jungle and they found some spring water, fresh water from creeks. So we all went there and used our bare hands to get water for drinking. And eventually, local Indonesian fishermen and farmers nearby would come around to trade food with our valuables or money. Those who have something to trade would get something to eat. If not, we'll continue to be the resourceful we could to go to the jungle and find what we can find. People can catch fish with their bare hands too. Luckily, because my mom gave me some jewelry, so I used those to trade for food and medicines for a short while. 3 months later, the UNHCR and the Red Cross found us. And that's when we found hope again. And less lives were lost. But by then, sadly, we have lost nearly 200 people.
So the 373 was down to, what, 170 by that point?
No, because we were not the only boat that were pulled to that island. Within a week, we end up with a few thousands. So the space just getting smaller and smaller, crammed with thousands of refugees, all hungry, thirsty, vulnerable, desperate.
I just want to pause for a moment, Karina, because the story that you're telling me, a lot of people are going to hear this and maybe have never heard to that extent before what an experience for a refugee is like. I know that particularly in the last 10 years, people have been labelled as boat people and have been labelled and kind of left at that. For anybody out there who maybe doesn't understand the significance or the severity of the situation, what does it feel like as somebody now sitting on the other side of that who is a refugee, who was a refugee? How do you feel when you see those stories or those comments about boat people and coming here via boat and just trying to take up space and jobs?
There are a lot to be sad about this situation and your question, I can answer in so many ways. Firstly, the term "boat people" to me was used in a very unkind way. You know, we were labeled, but we were actually just refugees. And we had no mean of transportation but use the boat. So all of a sudden, we were called boat people. But we were just human beings who flee from dangers and try to seek asylum somewhere. Okay? Until you are on a boat out in the ocean, such vast ocean in a flimsy wooden boat like that, you could never ever understand or imagine how vulnerable and insignificant you are, you know. And when we say, oh, these boat people are coming to our country illegally, they jump the queue, they come to take our job away and all of that, you know, they have money to fly into Indonesia so they can take the boat over here, that we need to know more before we come to that conclusion. Firstly, let's say in Vietnam, during my time that I escaped from Vietnam, the only way to get out of Vietnam was by boat. And we could not bring a passport because we couldn't get one. And if we go and apply for a passport, we will be put in prison right away because the government forbid people from leaving the country anyway. You know, so there's no such thing as they have the passport, they throw it away. And secondly, people, in general, we assume that refugees are poor. But that's not the case. Like my family, for example, before the communists took over, we were very comfortable. We had money and businesses and what have you. So we weren't poor. We were not uneducated, you know, but we had to leave. And once we come here, of course, we all have to eventually get a job and get on with our lives. But being a refugee, firstly, I'd like people to know that it's not a choice that we made. No one wants to be a refugee. I don't think people would willing to risk their life just to have a better life. It doesn't make sense. When we first come and resettle in this country, we will need help because of language barrier, because of culture differences, because we lost everything in our own home. We came with bare hand. Yes, we will need help. But we will not want to be a refugee forever. Somebody said something that I took it to heart. As a refugee, we need you to help us stand up. But once we can stand, we will walk and eventually we will run. So give us a start, give us a hand to start our new lives. But then we would want to be just like everybody else, have a life, have a meaningful life, you know, and contributing to society. And there are a lot of very wonderful success stories of refugees and immigrants, of how we contribute to the country that accepted us. Just that alone, I hope that the listeners will have an idea of how vulnerable it is to be a boat person and how we did not choose to be a boat person. Being a boat person is not an evil thing to
boat
do.
Boat person's not a dirty word to you.
No, I'm proud to be a boat person. Not that I wanted to be, but since it's part of my life, I survived. And because of that, I now have this new life that I am forever grateful for and proud of the accomplishments that I have made, which is to give back.
And we're going to talk about how you do that in a moment. So you're on this island in Indonesia. The Red Cross, the UNHCR come and you're granted refugee status in the US. When you arrive in the US, what's that like? Do you remember the first time that you stepped out onto US soil?
Yes, we arrived at the airport in Philadelphia, and it was in April, but it was still cold for someone who came from the tropical jungle, right? And my other siblings, whom we were away for nearly 2 years, or no more than 2 years, arrived with our cousin to pick us up. I couldn't believe myself. I tried to remember that it's not a dream, it's real. I was overjoyed to see them. I was so happy, but at the same time, I couldn't help but looking around, say, oh my God, it's big, you know, it's huge. The airport was so big and nice and clean. And then I remember sitting in the car coming back from the airport to the apartment where my family were living. Oh my God, the freeway, the lights, the bridges.
All the concrete.
Right, right. It was amazing. And then we had a date and a night, reunited and talk about, you know, our many years of what happened to us. But then my guardian put us to school immediately. So imagine me leaving the situation in Vietnam, endure the sea journey, lived in the jungle, came to America within 2 or 3 days, and then been thrown in high school with American kids. I remember came home the very first day, my cousin asked me, did you make any friends? And I looked at him, I said, no, they all look the same. And I thought that was the normal to me, but people who listened to that, they laughed because they would think the same when they come to Vietnam or China. We all look the same to them. So the American kids, I couldn't remember the face and the names of anyone, and then eventually, slowly, I picked up from there.
How old were you at that point?
Nearly 17.
I don't know from when you were a child, but when did you start to learn English?
Then.
When you got to the U.S.?
Yes. I learned English a little bit here and there in Vietnam and in the camp, but the extent of my vocabularies would be pencil, book, table, chair, apple, banana. Maybe that's it.
So going into a U.S. history class would have been a bit overwhelming?
Oh, yeah. I remember in Vietnam, I was really bad when it comes to science and math, except for chemistry. I don't know why I had a brain for chemistry, but I failed math, algebra, you know, calculus or what have you, because I did high school in Vietnam. And coming to America, I thought, I'm not going to make it. Not only I don't have the language to go through this, but if I take courses like history, literature, biology, which is non-science, I don't have the English skills to do that. But if I take math and science courses, I don't have the brain for that. And eventually, I don't know how, but I switched my brain and I excelled in math and I became the top A students in all of the science and math classes. So that comes to show, if you have to, you will make it.
There's something really beautiful about, and like so awful because I'm terrible at math, but there's something really beautiful about, despite what language you speak, maths is still the same.
Exactly, yeah.
So high school happens, you start your new life in Philadelphia. Your family, for the most part, are there. Are you still keeping in contact with your mum?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. We speak daily now to Viber and Messenger. But luckily, my parents and my siblings eventually came to America. So it took us 14 years to finally reunite in America. And then I leave them all there and come here.
Tell us a bit about sort of after high school in the U.S. What were you doing?
I went straight from high school to college with a scholarship, and I studied chemistry with a pre-medicine program, thinking that I would become a medical doctor. And I graduated from college as a chemist. I know that I would not pursue medical school at that point because my family was still in Vietnam and I need to get a job quickly to help them. And I do not think that being a medical doctor in America was an ideal situation for me. So I worked as a chemist. I went out to do technical sales. That was amazing. Absolutely loved it. For a number of years, I've changed career, developed my corporate life, and then later got more degree.
You've got quite a number of achievements to your name. If we were to look at your academic profile, Karina, what would all of those be? You have a PhD.
In humanities and the focus in the history of refugees in Hong Kong.
So there's one side, and then there is all the science side as well, which is what you originally went to college for too.
Yes, I had a bachelor in chemistry. I have a master in business administration in America, and I have an honor degree in cultural studies in Western Australia as well. So yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4 degrees in 4 different disciplines.
Not bad for somebody who had to leave their country by a boat, hey?
Wow, not only that, for someone who didn't speak English to begin with, I think, yes, it was a real challenge, but nonetheless, it was an amazing experience.
Thank you. So a couple of different degrees, a lot of different disciplines and career changes. How did you end up coming to Australia from the US?
I married an Aussie. What do we call relocating for love? My former husband is an Italian born, but he migrated to Australia when he was four. His whole family live here in Western Australia. So when we first got married, my former husband and I, or then husband, lived in America. We had our daughter, and then he asked me if I would move to Australia because he wanted to be with his parents as they were getting older. I agreed, and we moved here, and I'm glad he did ask me because I do absolutely love it here.
Did you have any reservations about moving from the US to Australia?
Not in terms of moving, because I'm quite adaptable and you know, adventurous. I don't mind start all over again, but I really missed my family and friends. I do not want to leave them, especially from what I've been through. Families is so important, and I have such a close family that it was heartbroken for me to be away from them. But luckily, the world became smaller with all of this capability of traveling, you know, so I do go home to see family regularly.
Do you remember the first time that you maybe were away from your family, but do you remember the first time that you ever had a Skype call or a video call with your family overseas?
Yes, but more importantly, I think this way back when we had, in the 90s, we had that three-way call. It was fascinating because my sister called me, and I was working for the U.S. Embassy, the U.S. Consulate in Vietnam. So she called me by this technology that she found. So I was on the phone with her, and then my older brother called her on her mobile, and she said, wait, hold on, I'll connect you and Wally. So I was amazed that the three of us can talk at the same time, right? So he called her on her mobile phone, and then all of a sudden, my older brother driving home from San Francisco to Sacramento called her, and she's like, okay, hold on, we have another brother joining in. So we had a four-way conversation. One was driving in the car, one was from a home line, one was on a mobile phone, and I was in Vietnam connecting to America. It's amazing. It's, you know, it's... Yeah, it blew my mind. Talking about the phone, in the 80s, when my father was released from prison in late 80s, after 14 years, he was finally home, and I heard that he wasn't well, so I tried to call my mom because I heard she had a telephone. So my family in Philadelphia drove to Canada to cross the border to call, because it was illegal to make a call to Vietnam in America at the time because there was no normalized relationship between the two countries. Once we got there, we connected the phone, couldn't call her. We drove home. Then later, I flew to Vancouver from California, got to a friend's house, borrowed the phone, called my mom, and we got connected. At that time, you're looking at back in the 80s, that cost me $10 per minute.
Oh my gosh.
Per minute. And I paid by credit card. And we cried, and my friend stood there and nudged me and said, too expensive to cry. And oh my God, it was $1,000 phone bill. But I finally got to hear my mom and my dad's voice after, you know, years apart.
There's a lot going on there. I had no idea that it was illegal to make a phone call to Vietnam in that era.
Because at the time, Vietnam was communist, it has not had normalized relationship with America. It's the same with how Americans were banned to go to Cuba before,
sure.
You know, they were open up. Sorry, I get sidetracked again, but I think you would like to hear this. The technology changed our ways of life and how we deal with things that happened to us. I lost my father due to COVID last Christmas. He was in America, and I'm here, and my other siblings all over the world. So we all watched our father's funeral via Messenger and Zoom.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
You just have to make do with what you can and have.
I'm really sorry to hear that. I'm sorry you weren't able to be there. But like you said, having that technology, otherwise, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More $10 a minute mm-hmm. phone calls.
Yeah.
So you've come to Australia. you've moved here with your then husband and your daughter as well. What was the first thing that you started to do in Australia? Were you working or were you back studying?
At first, I didn't work. I just took the time to get settled in, get my daughter to school, learn about lives in Australia, living in Australia, and then I decided it's time for me to do the book that I've always wanted to do. Luckily for me, my husband said to me, I don't have to go to work if I didn't want to. I can pursue what I want to do. So I set out to research for the book. And because of that, I ended up going back to school. If you ask me about my aspirations to get a master's degree or a doctorate degree or what, all those things, it was never a plan. And I take things that come to me and run with it. So I set out to study, do my book. But I also needed a part-time job because for someone who always worked full-time, I started to feel very bored with my time or useless. So I worked for a pharmaceutical company, and then I ended up working for the U.S. consulate. And then I quit, went back to school. And then once my book came out, I became a publisher instantly. So I published more books since. I continued to go to school and do a lot of different things. I am the ambassador for Australia for UNHCR since 2012. And UNHCR basically is an organization that established in the 50s after World War II to assist refugees, to give them protections and help them to resettle in different countries.
Can you tell us a bit about how that came about for you? How did you become involved and why is it important that you continue to stay involved?
After I published my book, Boat People, I was approached by the Australia for UNHCR office in Sydney to do a book launch of my book. And they have a yearly literary luncheon, and they would choose a book that was written by a refugee or for refugees to celebrate it. And they chose my book, and we met for the first time. We launched the book. We did very well, and my story started to gain awareness. Then I was appointed the special rep since then. I was extremely happy when they asked me to do that because it was an opportunity for me to give back. And I felt very honored. And I have been their rep since 2012.
And through that work, you've been able to obviously interact with a lot of refugee families and help them resettle here. It must be really nice at the end of the day when you get to hang up the phone or drive away from one of those families that have resettled in Australia to know that you have been able to truly give back and give to them knowledge and experience that you have also had yourself that not many other Australians would be able to give and help them with.
A lot of my work involved with advocating for refugees. I'm giving voices to refugees. I help the public to understand more about the plight of refugees, and I help the UNHCR promote what they do to help people understand their roles, what their needs are, and how others can help them. And also I participate in fundraising activities to help the UNHCR to have the funding to provide the basic needs to refugees globally. We have the highest number of refugees since the World War II, and the numbers keep on growing.
So it's not a matter of there, you know, not being enough people and it not being a big enough issue, because the numbers speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just is a matter of people placing the amount of time and importance on it then.
Yeah, we are looking at nearly 20 million displaced people in the world right now. 20 million, that's the size of Australia population.
So it's time we all did something about it.
Right now, we are particularly appealing for the Afghanistan refugees in addition to the millions others. The world would never stop having refugees. Many people would have to flee their country for safety. We should never stop giving help to others.
I'm learning as we keep talking, Karina, and you keep telling me about all the different career paths that you've kind of had your hand in a few different areas. Is there one that you particularly absolutely love?
The one that's most meaningful to me was when I worked for the U.S. consulate under the refugee resettlement session, because I was able to help other Vietnamese people to get out of Vietnam as refugees and resettle in America and start their lives again. That was the first time that I was able to give back in a very meaningful and have direct impact way. And I can relate to what they went through. I can use my experience and have empathy for them. So that was meaningful. In terms of career, like you said, I've done a lot of different things. So I was in marketing, in sales, human resources, admin, operations management. In terms of industries, I have worked for the hospitals, semiconductor industry, manufacturing, pharmaceutical, medical equipment, you name it. I absolutely loved it. I had such privilege to experience different things. I really enjoy being an outside sales rep, especially being a technical rep, you know, so I get to apply my technical skills and knowledge, but also as a business person as well.
It comes from your mum, because your mum was a businesswoman too, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
So your book that you wrote is Boat People, Personal Stories from the Vietnamese Exodus 1975 to 1996, a very, very personal, very close story. Why did you decide to publish your personal experience and to share the personal experience of what can be quite a painful time for a lot of people?
Firstly, I wanted to do that book as recording the history for my daughter and Jiren and her generations, especially those whose parents were refugees like myself. I was thinking of my nieces and nephews because they were too young to understand that at that time. But as they grow older, that's part of the heritage that they should know. So that's my main motivation. But once I set out to research and do this book, I realized that it is a bigger piece of history. And it's the knowledge a lot of people would benefit from gaining that knowledge and understanding. I've interviewed people and put and included a lot of stories from survivors of the Exodus. Also people who had rescued and helped the refugees, so we can hear the perspective from someone who were non-refugees. But I had to include a chapter of my journey because the book was for my daughter, but it wasn't about my life and my journey only. It was a painful process, not necessarily for me, because I had the opportunities to tell my stories over the years, so that all the, you know, the angers and the sadness and the fears that are, you know, from telling the stories many times. But from interviewing people for the first time that they tell their story, it was extremely emotional and difficult. But in a way, it was a good thing that I started this process, because it helped a few people to be able to let go of their pain, for people to be able to move forward, and for people to feel that they belong, they were not alone, and that their voice was finally heard.
A lot of really important reasons to do it. One of those being as well, I think, is sometimes people don't really talk about their past and their history. It's not talked about in amongst your family or your social circles, because it is sometimes quite a painful or sad or angry time. So the fact that you've been able to offer closure to a lot of people must feel nice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then the benefits of this book to other people were beyond my expectations. I have had Vietnamese parents call me and said, thanks to the book, that now they were able to communicate with the children at a different level. You were right. A lot of people who've been through this experience did not want to share that story. Well, for a number of reasons. One is some of them wanted to put all of that sadness behind and move forward, even though they could never forget it. You know, it could never be behind them. And two is that some of them feel that it's too painful to talk about it or too ashamed to talk about it. And some of them didn't want the children to go through the pain by listening to what they have been through. But interestingly, a lot of the families, the Vietnamese families, did not share the stories with the children because of language barrier. When they first arrived to America or Australia or any settlement countries, they were focusing on starting the new life, put the kids to school. They didn't want to talk about it. And then as life goes on and time passes, they not okay, time to tell the kids. The thing was, the children do not speak Vietnamese. the parents do not speak English. So there's language barrier, so they can only say things in general, but they cannot describe the journey in details. So with my book came out in English, it was very well received and appreciated by many Vietnamese parents.
You wrote this in part for your daughter. What was the reaction like or the conversation like between you after she had read it?
Well, my daughter listened to my talk at schools and at, over the years, so she sort of understand this already, but not in reading it and look at the pictures like the book presented. But I know that she is appreciative of the book because it finally give her that answer of why is it that mom is Vietnamese but mom lives here in Australia or in America. You know, her heritage, why did she still go back to Vietnam to visit grandma? It could be confusing at times. Yeah, I think it was the right thing to do.
Oh, I think so. It sounds like you have helped a lot of people, even just to have that conversation with their children. The PhD that you have acquired since then in 2018 is in humanities. I mean, it's pretty obvious that a lot of what you have been working towards, this PhD would make a lot of sense. How was it acquiring your PhD?
Before I answer this one, could I just mention one thing?
Of course.
The book both people not only benefit Vietnamese children, but also Australians. Because the book is now used in many high schools. So I'm very, very proud of that.
I'm Congratulations.
Very happy that. Thank you. Thank you. So the PhD, I chose to focus on the history of refugees in Hong Kong for two reasons. One was I was approached by a group of former government officials in Hong Kong and the people who used to work with the Vietnamese refugees to assist them to record this history for them. And two is because I realized that out of the countries in the neighboring near Vietnam that host the Vietnamese refugees, Hong Kong was by far the most complicated and have the longest history of Vietnamese refugees. The best part was the research part. It's so enjoyable. But also it's very taxing in many ways. I travel back and forth to Hong Kong many times, researching material, interview people, travel to different places and went back to the refugee camps. It was difficult physically and emotionally as well. I spent countless hours online and at library researching material. But when it comes to writing, oh my God, that's what almost every PhD student would dread doing. Many people came to the end of the research and said, no, don't want to finish because just didn't want to write that thesis. It was challenging, especially for me, even though, you know, I'm very comfortable speaking English. But when it comes to writing, I still have the difficulties because English is not my first language. I learned English in America through high school, but I was never given the chance to learn English program. So I still have difficulties with grammar. But there are always people who help me editing, so that's not a problem. I was lucky to finish my PhD because I had very, very supportive and wonderful supervisors that guided me through the process.
It sounds like in a lot of your work, and we've mentioned this before about helping and giving back to other people, and I want to touch on the Graves of Refugees work that you've done as well. Can you explain to us a little bit more about how you've helped those Vietnamese family find graves of loved ones?
Yes, I started out with finding the grave of my own cousin back in 1998. That was the first time I returned to the jungles in Indonesia after I left there. And my cousin, who was very, very close, who was very close to me, he was 17, I was 16 when we both escaped, and he died in the jungle. I carried that pain for a long time and feel sad for him. But when I saw my aunt in California, I realized that the loss of her son had taken away her desire to live. You know, she suffered that pain for so long. 19 years later, she still set a bowl and a pair of chopsticks at every single meal for him. So I realized that it's not just her feeling the pain of a mother who lost a child, but I think it's compounded with guilt, that she felt guilty for unable to give him a proper burial. She felt guilty for unable to go back and revisit the grave as we would yearly. She doesn't even know if the grave was still there, because I understand that she buried him in the middle of the stormy night in the dark. And then within hours, they were evacuated out of that island, and she never get a chance to go back. So I think living with that memory was so painful for her.
Mm.
So I thought that, okay, I can travel. I'm adventurous. You know, I can see what I can do. Maybe I can find a grave site and burn an incense for him and let her know that it's okay or not. So I set out to do that with my younger brother and my cousin, and that was 19 years after he died. And I wasn't even there when he was buried. But miraculously, we made it to the jungle in Indonesia from America, and then we came up on grave sites that we didn't even know what was his or not, and there were graves hidden underneath trees and branches, and they were all unmarked and they all looked the same. But we found the right grave, and I cremated his remains, brought the ashes back to my aunt, and I watched her transformed. And that's when I realized that she found closure. And I shared that story with other people just to give hope to refugee families who've lost their loved ones in that way. But then unexpectedly, families from around the world contacted me and asked me to help them to return to these jungles to help them find the graves of their loved ones. Initially, I said no, because I don't think I could recreate that journey. It was nearly impossible to find a grave. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. But 10 years later, I had a change of mind, a change of heart, and I decided to help, and it grew from there. So since 2009, I have done many trips.
You mentioned it earlier on in this conversation, Karina, about the conditions that you were living with when you left Vietnam. And obviously, I can imagine that it's very hard to be able to pinpoint particular grave sites and particular locations. The other thing that I wonder about is that painful for you to have to revisit those places that didn't bring such nice and joyful times to you personally?
Especially the first trip, it was extremely hard. Because for years, I didn't want to go back there in my memory, didn't want to think about it. It was too scary, too painful, too sad. But for me, finally stand there at the spot where I was nearly died every day, images of people who died and a child that I carry in my arms when she already died, helped deliver a baby in the middle of a jungle at night. All of that memory just flushed back in my mind. I was shaking. I was overwhelmed with emotion. But once I got through that initial shock stage of mind, then I find the strength to continue to do it through the fact that I know that it's helpful to others. I know that it's important, and deep down, it was healing for me as well. And the more I do, the more healing I find for myself.
And so I guess seeing the change in your aunt when you were able to give her son's ashes, that must have been, I imagine, a moment when you realize, you go, this is helping so many more people than you could ever conceive.
Mm-hmm.
Whereabouts is the project now? How many grave sites have you been able to find?
Well, I have returned to these jungles 8 times since 2009. And the last time was 4 years ago. And now, because of COVID, it will be longer until the next time I return. I have brought so many families back. So I think I have helped maybe 20 families. But I have found at least 100 graves, and I would share the names of the tombstones that's still legible on my website or by email, or letting people know what I saw. And sadly, a lot of them were unmarked, but I have seen many, many grave sites in the jungles.
You're doing this of your own accord. Is there anybody or any place or organization helping you?
No, I just did it on my own, and I'm glad that I'm able to. Yeah.
Does it make you upset that there's no one else, maybe a bigger body that's able to help you do that though?
No, because I think if I ask for help, there might be organizations and people who will help, but I chose not to. because I think once you start asking for money and donations, then it's become a different thing. And then there's a lot of other complicated things attached to it. Having said that, many of the families that come along know that not only I put out my time and effort and my own grief and pain to help them for themselves, but also it's my own cost. So some of them will contribute toward my airfare, because it cost me a lot of money to not only the airfare accommodations, but the gears and everything and phone calls that I have to make to Indonesia to get people to help. On an average, it takes me 6 months to prepare a trip. When I first started, I was working, so I had to save my yearly holidays and money to do it. So it's almost like people get the holidays to travel. I get my holidays to take these people to the jungle. It was not a holiday, but it was extremely meaningful for me. So I appreciate it as well.
A very selfless act. There are a few more things that I do want to talk about because you have done so many things. One of them, which I found very surprising, and I wasn't sure if this was something that you wanted to talk about, but is your acting career.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about how acting became a thing for you.
I just finished my study and waiting to graduate, so I really have nothing to do. And I received an email that was forwarded by the president of the Vietnamese community in Perth. He sent out this email to everybody with an attachment that a casting director is looking for a Vietnamese woman to play a role in a TV drama series with or without acting experience. If you're interested, you can sign up for audition. And the key word was with or without acting experience. And I thought, I'm a Vietnamese woman. I'm within this age group. I don't have acting experience, but I was curious. So I put my name up and my phone number and my picture in this email, replied, and then I got called in for audition.
What was that like, going to the audition?
It was exciting. It was interesting to me because I always loved different experiences. My head was wrapped around the experience rather than the role, you know. And so I went on with it and did the best I could, have some fun, was nervous, was scary, but I was not as nervous as I am now anytime I audition for something else, because back then I wasn't intent to get the role. I just wanted to go and see what it's like, knowing, thinking that they're not going to get me, you know, choose me, but I want to give it a try. And then when they gave me the call back, and that's when I said, oh, wait a minute here, it could be something. And then I started to get nervous. And then when I got the second call back, and that's when I thought, oh, my God, this could be real. And then my daughter said, God, I went, by the time you get a second call back, I thought, maybe I don't know my mom at all.
I'm an actor now, honey.
Yes. And not until I sat down and looked at the contract that I realized that it was one of the main casts, and that is 60, 90, you know, episodes. And I said, oh, my God. But I still did not know the enormity of it because I was not in the field, as all the actors and actresses would appreciate it a lot more. But having said that, I absolutely loved it, and I want to do more.
Can you tell us what the show was?
It was The Heights with ABC, and I was Iris.
Is there something on my face?
You know, I get it now. All these snooping and interfering.
I don't snoop.
You just care about me.
You are Iris from The Heights. A program lots of people would have seen. Hilariously funny. Very, very good. Congratulations for that role. Are you still looking and acting now?
Yes, I am. Yes, I'd like to do more. I enjoyed it.
Are you working on anything at the moment?
Yes, I go for auditions here and there. I was in a short film after that. And I was also in a couple of other short films. Some were smaller roles, some was larger roles. And I was also in a commercial recently.
So, you are busy.
A little bit, yes.
Just mm-hmm. a little bit.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of awards that you have been recognised for your contribution to human rights, to humanities, to your refugee work and everything else in between. One of those awards and one of those recognitions is as part of the inaugural inductees for the WA Women's Hall of Fame, which is where this podcast has stemmed from, looking at some of the inductees. You're from the inaugural class. What was it like getting the conversation or the phone call to say, can we induct you into the first wave?
Oh, my God. I thought there must be a mistake somewhere, right? And believe it or not, I actually Googled Hall of Fame to really know what it's like and what it means. And surprised, extremely surprised. And then once I got through that stage, then I felt extremely honored. And then getting more into the inductions process, looking at the profile of all the inductees, I felt extremely humble.
Why is it important to give recognition to the refugee experience?
It is important for refugees. Let's just answer that question directly. Because, like I said before, refugees are just ordinary people like us who have the same needs. You know, they want to have a safety life. They want to be able to live a meaningful life. They want to contribute to society. They want to raise the children, give the children the best future they could. They were refugees, and actually, because they were refugees, they were put through challenges. And if they overcame that challenge, they show some strength, they show some character, some diversities, and those are the things that we should celebrate. And as a group of women, that just showed that women are important in society. Women is a part of the community. When we were recognized, it's actually encouraged other people as well, and it gives role models. People overcome their challenges in different ways, but as refugees, we have multiple challenges. We have suffered multiple losses, and we feel excluded sometimes. We feel vulnerable. But we have to gather ourselves and our strength and resilience to overcome all of that. And then if we exceed and we achieve more, then it comes to show to people that refugees are just ordinary people who thrive for success.
Before we let you go, Karina, two last questions. The name of this podcast series is Herstory, which is a play on the word history. It's mm-hmm. about women-focused retellings of their past. Have you heard the word herstory before?
No, I have not.
Do you have any thoughts about the word herstory?
It's interesting. I like it. Yes. Mm-hmm. I always love to tell stories. I think history is very important to record, to reserve, because we all learn from history, and history does repeat.
Thanks to Dr. Karina Huang and all the women at the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. While they're not inductees yet, I've got to give big thanks to the women who make this podcast happen. Our executive producer and one day inductee is Danae Gibson. Courtney Withers, Fiona Bartholomew and Sophie Minisale are all fabulous and are our assistant producers. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses, an artwork from Peter Roebuck. Zoe Zarzicki also helped to edit this podcast. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. If you're looking for some more information or resources for asylum seekers and refugees in Australia, we've got a couple of phone numbers for you. In Western Australia, you can contact CARAD, that's the Centre for Asylum Seekers, Refugees and Detainees, on 08 9227 7322. Otherwise, you can contact the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, which is a national organisation. They're available at 03 9326 6066. And always, Lifeline's number is 13 11 14. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll catch you next week for episode 3.